Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who examines charges that the Bush administration kidnapped Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, deposing him from power after a three-week armed rebellion. Leslie Kagan, national coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who describes plans for a global day of protests against the U.S. war and occupation of Iraq that will take place on Saturday, March 20th. And Hank Dittmar, executive director of Reconnecting America, who talks about the problems he sees with the federal transportation bill and his organization's efforts to have transportation serve human needs. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Under the nose of the Bush White House, a top Pentagon planning unit has concluded that global warming is a real threat to national security. The report noted that by the year 2020, there is risk of dramatic climate change that could produce a series of disasters such as mega droughts, mass starvation, or even a nuclear war among nations like China, India, and Pakistan. Pentagon planners are also worried about the possibility that Northern Europe could be plunged into a new ice age, and that the American Midwest, sometimes called the breadbasket to the world, might be turned into a dust bowl. According to The Nation magazine, the oil-friendly Bush White House will have a difficult time discrediting the Pentagon report. It was done by a team led by Andrew Marshall, a longtime Pentagon analyst who was a close associate to Donald Rumsfeld when he was first Secretary of Defense in the 1970s. The report is likely to put more pressure on the World Bank to accept its own Extractive Industries Review Commission recommendation to cut off all funding for coal development projects and to phase out all oil production projects by 2008. Over the last few weeks, nearly 25,000 people from the war-torn Darfur region of Sudan have fled across the border to Chad seeking safety. Those fleeing Sudan are short of food and water, and UN aid workers want to deliver supplies to refugee camps before the rainy season starts. Until the early 1900s, Darfur was run by local tribal leaders who often clashed with the Central Sudanese government. Conflict increased after the National Islamic Front seized power in 1989. The rebellion in Darfur by the Sudan Liberation Army has been fueled by mistreatment of tribal elders, sheikhs, and lawyers who've been arrested. The rebels claim that government troops have raided homes of innocent people and tortured their victims. According to the World Press Review magazine, the conflict in Darfur now looks like the long-running civil war in southern Sudan. Government raids by helicopter gunships, attacks by government-backed militias, and denial of relief supplies. The longtime Israeli nuclear weapons whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu has pledged to fight government restrictions once he is released from solitary confinement on April 21st. In a statement released by his brother Meir, Vanunu said, "In the end, the locks will be open. They did not break me or drive me mad after all those years in isolation." While in London in 1986, after giving interviews about Israel's secret nuclear weapons program, Vanunu was lured to Rome by an American-born woman who was actually a Mossad agent. Once there, the Israeli Secret Service kidnapped him and brought him to a Jerusalem court, where he was sentenced to 18 years in prison for treason. Vanunu blew the whistle on Israel's nuclear weapons program after working in its Dimona atomic reactor for 9 years. In approving his release, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon imposed new security measures on Vanunu, such as monitoring his phone calls and supervising with whom he can meet and what he may discuss. In recent statements, Vanunu promised to continue to speak out against nuclear weapons in the world and in Israel. According to the Independent newspaper, many arms control experts believe that Israel has between 100 and 400 nuclear weapons. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After several weeks of attacks on Haiti's major cities, an armed rebellion led by death squad leaders and former soldiers succeeded in overthrowing the democratically elected government of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Although the Bush administration and U.S. media outlets initially reported that President Aristide had resigned his office to avoid more bloodshed, the former Catholic priest asserts he was kidnapped by the U.S. on the morning of Sunday, February 29th, and flown to the Central African Republic. Mr. Aristide, in calls to U.S. Congressperson Maxine Waters, Randall Robinson, former director of the group TransAfrica, and news organizations, asserted that he had been the victim of a U.S. coup and forced to leave Haiti at the point of a gun. Secretary of State Colin Powell described the allegations as absolutely baseless and absurd. In denying the charge, the Bush administration points to a letter of resignation that they say was signed by Aristide. But while some of the facts surrounding the president's exit from Haiti are still unknown, it is clear that the White House withheld all support for Aristide's democratic government until the head of state departed. Even as hundreds of U.S. troops entered Haiti's capital of Port-au-Prince, armed rebels and death squads have murdered Aristide's supporters, and rebel leader Guy Philippe declared himself the new head of a reconstituted Haitian army. From exile in France, former Haitian dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier vowed to return to Haiti. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who examines U.S. policy toward Haiti during this latest crisis and the claim that the Bush administration was complicit in the coup which overthrew President Aristide.
Well, those reports from President Aristide talking to both Randall Robinson as well as to Maxine Waters, Congresswoman Waters, were that essentially he was at his house at Tabar, which is somewhat near the airport outside of downtown Port-au-Prince, and U.S. officials, Marines and others, I think, came to his house and essentially said, from what I understand, look, you stay around at this house. We've already told your security detail to get out of here. We're going to let you and your family be killed and let the guys come in and kill people. That's what I understand happened here. At that point, they said, look, you're going to come with us. And they surrounded him. The Marines surrounded him. They accompanied him to an airplane. They put him on an airplane. They didn't tell him where he was going, he and his wife and his sister. They shut the shades on the airplane, and they flew him to the Central African Republic, where he is now, and according to the reports there, it's not clear that he's at all free to leave, because apparently the house is surrounded by soldiers. So it seems to me it was a clear case of an international abduction of the president, the head of state of Haiti. To me, the abduction is only the end of the whole matter. I mean, the beginning of the matter, of course, is that this coup was planned by the United States, carried out by the United States, at the cost of scores of lives, hundreds of lives probably by this time, and the end of Haitian democracy. It's been in the works not just in the last few days, not just in the last few months, but really almost since, probably since the day Aristide, in fact, before he took office, they didn't want him there. So this has been a long time coming. They've already done it once successfully. Clinton put him back. They then done it again.
Press reports stated that President Aristide wrote a resignation letter, which was widely distributed in the U.S. press. And I'm wondering if you think that was phonied up by the military, given the reports that President Aristide himself related to Randall Robinson and Congresswoman Maxine Waters.
There's no doubt that everything that President Aristide did that evening of Saturday evening was coerced at the point of a gun. And what I mean by that is they basically said, we will kill you and we will kill your supporters in Port-au-Prince unless you sign some kind of a letter. Whether he wrote the letter himself, whether they dictated it, whether they filled in a blank afterwards, I obviously don't know. But whatever was signed, to me, has no legal efficacy. It doesn't mean he's not still the president of Haiti. In my view, my position is very clear here. You don't reward people that make a coup, whether it be the thugs that have taken over Port-au-Prince or the United States that is now appointed a so-called interim president. This was a coerced resignation, if it was ever a resignation at all, and therefore it has no account in international law or in terms of who is ruling Haiti today. Basically, the Haitian president is still President Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
The similarities with a previous coup attempt in Venezuela are striking. People will remember in 2002, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez was reported by the Bush administration and the U.S. media both as having resigned from office. Later, when Chavez was freed from captivity by loyal army troops and hundreds of thousands of his supporters, it was learned that Washington and the coup plotters had fabricated the story of the resignation. So this all seems to resonate in a way that impugns the veracity of the reports we've been getting.
When you say striking similarity to the Venezuela coup, it's striking and it's also incredibly disgusting and sad to me that this government, after making coups from 1954 forward, from Guatemala to Iran to other places in the world, is still at the same game, is still at the business, whether it's in Venezuela or here, of making coups. Presumably they got Aristide out of Haiti to avoid their Chavez problem that they had in Venezuela, which is essentially someone who they thought they had gotten rid of coming back. And they just wanted to get him out of the country, in my view.
Michael Ratner, having followed events in Haiti closely over many years and the struggle for democracy there, what do you think should happen at this point here in the United States in terms of a congressional investigation or demands for an international inquiry at the United Nations?
Well, first of all, there should be a refusal to recognize the new Haitian government, so-called new Haitian government. Unfortunately, that's generally an executive function, and I'm sure this executive being behind the coup will want to recognize the new government. But hopefully Congress is unlikely, again, because they're a Republican domination, but at least some debate about who is the legitimate government of Haiti right now. That's the first level. The second level of that, of course, should go on at the UN and at the Organization of American States. The UN should simply refuse to seat those who are getting the spoils of the coup. There's a legitimate president of Haiti right now. That's President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The UN should not seat the rump delegation, the rump president, basically appointed it, took office because they had a gun at the Haitian people. So that's clear to me. The same should be with regard to the Inter-American Human Rights Commission. With regard to Congress, of course there should be an investigation. It should be swift and fast. It should find out what the United States did here, what the government's role is here, what the Bush administration's role was, why basically the Bush administration refused to come to the aid of a democratic leader when all he would have needed was 50 soldiers to put down the people in Gonaïves, soldiers who it's clear were armed with modern, up-to-date weapons taken out of the Dominican Republic from a catch that the United States had given to the Dominican Army. So there should be an investigation. There should be much stronger than that. This is impeachment stuff. This is high crimes and misdemeanors. This is a crime. It's a crime of aggression. It's a crime against the territorial and political integrity of Haiti. This is a crime. Bush is guilty of a crime. Colin Powell, I think, has played here the most pernicious, nasty, dirty role. I can't look at him now without seeing someone who's essentially a thuggish man who is lying to the American people about what happened in Haiti.
Michael, what's the outlook for Haiti after the coup? Guy Philippe and the other members of the armed rebellion have stated their intention to reestablish, reconstitute the Haitian military. And as you just mentioned, there's the fear by many Lavalas Party and Aristide supporters that there will be reprisals, killings, and burnings of homes and such that we've already seen some of in the last few weeks.
Yeah, that's correct, Scott. We already have seen some. Ivan Neptune, the house he was living in, was burnt to the ground or damaged very badly. He's the prime minister of Haiti. And that's going on now, and that's, I think, purposely being allowed by the United States. It's one of the reasons the United States, I think, has put up this floating wall of ships so no one can really escape from Haiti. They're going to systematically, I think, wipe out a lot of the key Aristide Lavalas supporters. That these guys are going to be part of the reconstituted army, you might as well just set the clock back to Duvalier and just say, well, we're back there right now, and we're back there really because of what my country has done.
That was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at www.ccr-ny.org. 1 year after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, American soldiers and Iraqi citizens are continuing to die in the ongoing conflict between occupation troops and insurgents bent on driving them out. Recent deadly attacks occurred on March 2nd, when simultaneous bombings targeting Shiite holy shrines killed more than 140 civilians, some of whom were Iranian religious pilgrims. Despite the violence and instability, the Bush administration says it will transfer authority over the nation from Washington's Administrator Paul Bremer to the U.S.-installed Iraqi Governing Council on June 30th, but with the Pentagon maintaining large numbers of American soldiers in Iraq for years to come. Critics charge that the transfer date was dictated by Mr. Bush's re-election campaign rather than in the interest of the Iraqi people. After Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the most powerful leader of Iraq's Shiite majority, rejected a U.S. plan for regional caucuses, the U.N. is now working to organize a process for elections that will select an interim government. It's been just over a year since 15 million people in hundreds of cities participated in the February 15th International Day of Demonstrations, organized to resist the Bush administration's plan to attack Iraq. Although those protests were unsuccessful in preventing war, the movement has remained active in opposing the U.S. occupation. On March 20th, the one-year anniversary of the U.S.-British bombing and invasion of Iraq, protests will be held again in cities across the globe. The Global Day of Action will call for an end to the occupation of Iraq and the Bush administration's militaristic foreign policies. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who describes plans for the March 20th actions and reflects on the peace movement since the Iraq invasion.
Thinking of February 15th, about how incredible that day was and that kind of moment in world history. I think it was probably the largest gathering of people, on a global, in terms of a global day of protest on any issue at any time in history. You know, we need to remember that not only most of the people of the world, but most of the governments of the world didn't want this war to happen. Of course, we were not able to stop the Bush administration, although I do think, I mean, we'll never know for sure, but I do think that the movement in this country and the global movement perhaps had some impact on the conduct of the war. I don't think the plans for the kind of shock and awe campaign that we had heard so much about, I don't think they were actually able to carry it out in quite the same force or with the same brutality that they had initially planned. But I don't mean to imply it at all that what they did was minor or lightweight. I mean, there was a major military assault by the world's most powerful military force with the most massive array of deadly weapons that human history has ever seen. So I don't mean to underplay what they did do, but I do think we had a little bit of an impact in slowing things down and the way the war was conducted. But I also think that part of what happened is that the arrogance of Bush and his whole administration was really quite exposed, and many, many people, again, around the world, but certainly many, many people in this country really said, wait a second, folks, this guy is, and his whole administration has just gone too far. So part of what happened on February 15th was, that was kind of the most visible expression of this truly massive movement, but it also was a kind of public declaration that a new movement had been born in this country or had come to life in this country and around the world, and a movement, that sometimes would be stronger and sometimes weaker, but one that was not going away.
Your organization and dozens of coalition partners are calling for demonstrations on March 20th, the first year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. What's the coalition calling for then? What's the central message during those demonstrations?
March 20th is the one-year anniversary of the beginning of this phase of the war against Iraq. Remember, the attacks on Iraq go back many years. So it's a very timely and appropriate date for people all around the world, and the call has gone out from the World Social Forum and a number of other international anti-war and peace networks for people to take to the streets again. And we're calling for people all around the country, whether it's in a small neighborhood activity or a big citywide activity, to go out in the streets and to challenge the Bush administration. And now, of course, every day we hear more and more about the lies, being exposed and the way the Bush administration set us up for this war and set the world up for it. Anyway, here in New York, there will be a major demonstration that it will be more than just a New York City demonstration. It's really a New England and Northeast-wide demonstration, a regional action. We formed a coalition. We called it the March 20th Mobilizing Committee. There was another coalition formed called the March 20th National Coalition. Both of those coalitions are now working together on a unified demonstration here in New York on March 20th. And we are expecting, tens of thousands of people to join us on that day, again, calling not only for an end to the occupation in Iraq, but also shedding light on how that situation connects to the war at home, to the economic issues that we're struggling with here at home, and also to elevate, to call more attention to the situation in Palestine and the occupied territories. We think it's time for the peace movement in this country, the anti-war movement, to call attention especially to the role of the U.S. government in maintaining that military occupation as well.
And Leslie, I know down the road, your organization, United for Peace and Justice, is coordinating large demonstrations to greet the Democrats when they meet for their national convention in Boston, and the Republicans also when they meet in New York City for their convention.
Yes, we can't be naive about the fact that this is an election year. We are not, as a coalition, directly involved in the election. What we think is that this election year is a critical time to keep people mobilized, to keep a focus on the important issues of the day. We very much hope that the work that we all do, not just United for Peace and Justice, but all of us, the work that we all do this year will mean that whoever sits in the White House come next January, that that there will be an even stronger movement for peace and justice. And so we are bringing that message to the Democratic Convention in Boston in July, and here in New York City we will do a massive demonstration on August 29th, the day before the Republican Convention opens, and throughout that week there will be many, many activities. Again, we invite all your listeners to join us.
That was Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice. To get more information on local and national March 20th protests, contact the group at area code 212-868-5545 or visit their website at www.unitedforpeace.org. Republicans, who control both the House and Senate, had been planning to attach controversial energy legislation to the $300 billion transportation bill that's also moving through Congress. But that idea was eventually dropped, and the transportation bill has generated its own controversy. For more than 10 years, the percentage of the budget going toward non-highway projects, though minuscule, was on an upward trend. However, under President Bush and the Republican-controlled Congress, that trend may now be swinging downward. Many who consider themselves environmentalists, smart growth advocates, or public health promoters have weighed in to try to squeeze dollars out of the transportation bill to support other forms of transportation that take people into account, not just cars. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Hank Dittmar, Executive Director of Reconnecting America, about the problems he sees with the transportation bill and his organization's efforts to have transportation serve human needs, like safe cycling, walking routes, and supporting the development of transit-centered communities.
There's been a big movement over the last 12 or 13 years to refocus national transportation policy from building a road network to connect all our cities to building a more integrated transportation system and providing people with alternatives. The era of building the interstate highway system did, in fact, connect our cities with convenient all-weather roads, but it also destroyed a lot of low-income neighborhoods. It resulted in sort of the death of mass transit systems, and it made a lot of cities virtually unwalkable. And at the same time, you know, automobile transportation has led to air pollution and contributes about a third of the carbon emissions for global climate change.
In the transportation bill currently before Congress, the Bush administration, the Senate, and the House are all seeking increased funding that would go to mostly highway spending of between $250 billion and $375 billion over 6 years. That's a lot of money. What else does the bill do?
Many of the proposals pending in Congress are trying to do away with environmental protections and public information provisions. Generally, the dedication of funding to other forms of transportation. For instance, there is a proposal called environmental streamlining, which says that it's about making it smoother for projects to get through the process, but really involves limiting the input of environmental and resource agencies into the process and limiting the ability of the public to challenge the purpose and need for highway projects.
Where does the bill stand right now in Congress?
It's caught right now in a debate over how much money various states get, and very little attention is being paid to what policy direction we want to go with transportation.
You've written a new book called The New Transit Town that looks at how cities are redesigning themselves around transit. So what do you want to see?
We think that it's important to realize that we've spent the last 50 years building probably the world's best highway system, and that virtually every American owns an automobile. And to say that families need to abandon their automobiles and ride transit or walk wherever they go just isn't possible. But what we think that we need to do as a matter of national policy is really focus attention on putting choice back into the equation so that people don't have to drive so much, so that public transit is easily available to most Americans. Half of American families don't have access to public transit right now, that our streets are walkable without taking our lives in our hands. And we think this actually is a recipe that's good for the environment, but also good for the economy. The demographics of our country are changing, and increasingly as the baby boom generation ages, they want to live in walkable, mixed-use communities that have access to transit. And the kids of the baby boom generation, the people in their 20s and early 30s, are increasingly wanting to live in urban settings. Our households are getting smaller, and all of this sort of says that the direction we need to invest in is to supplement our aviation and highway systems with a convenient network of mass transit, intercity rail, and bus systems.
I've read that 30% of the people in the U.S. don't drive, so that's a pretty big constituency for transit or some other form of getting around besides cars.
In the last dozen or so years, we really have shifted patterns of spending. In the 5 years before the 1991 bill, ICE-T, passed at the federal level, we spent $3 million of federal funding on bicycle and pedestrian facilities. And now we're up to spending a few hundred million a year. What we are also asking for in this new bill is whenever state highway departments, who control most of the highway spending, build transportation facilities, that they provide routine accommodation for bicyclists and pedestrians. And this is really the notion that the roadways ought to accommodate all users, and that they ought to be designed in a way that really focuses on the more vulnerable users, which are pedestrians and bicyclists.
That was Hank Dittmar of Reconnecting America. Contact the group at area code 505-426-8055 or visit their website at www.reconnectingamerica.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Toth. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. We would like to take this opportunity to thank Sasha Summer Cousineau for her dedication and friendship in the production of this program and wish her the best of luck as she moves to a new home on the West Coast. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.